THE POT OF TULIPS by FITZJAMES O'BRIEN. 28 years ago I went to spend the summer at an old Dutch villa which then lifted its head from the wild country that in present days has been tamed down into a site for a crystal palace. Madison Square was then a wilderness of fields and scrub oak, here and there diversified with tall and stately elms. Worthy citizens who could afford two establishments rusticated in the groves that then flourished where ranks of brownstone porticos now form the landscape, and the locality of 40th Street, where my summer palace stood, was justly looked upon as at an enterprising distance from the city. I had an imperious desire to live in this house ever since I can remember. I had often seen it when a boy, and its cool verandas and quaint garden seemed, whenever I passed, to attract me irresistibly. In after years, when I grew up to man's estate, I was not sorry, therefore, when one summer, fatigued with the labors of my business, I beheld a notice in the papers intimating that it was to be let furnished. I hastened to my dear friend Jasper Joyce, painted the delights of this rural retreat in the most glowing colors, easily obtained his assent to share the enjoyments and the expense with me, and a month afterwards we were taking our ease in this new paradise. Independent of early associations, other interests attached me to this house. It was somewhat historical, and had given shelter to George Washington on the occasion of one of his visits to the city. Furthermore, I knew the descendants of the family to which it had originally belonged. Their history was strange and mournful, and it seemed to me as if their individuality was somehow shared by the edifice. It had been built by a Mr. Van Coren, a gentleman of Holland, the younger son of a rich mercantile firm at The Hague, who had emigrated to this country in order to establish a branch of his father's business in New York, which even then gave indications of the prosperity it has since reached with such marvelous rapidity. He had brought with him a fair young Belgian wife, a loving girl, if I may believe her portrait, with soft brown eyes, chestnut hair, and a deep, placid contentment spreading over her fresh and innocent features. Her son, Alan Van Coren, had her picture, an old miniature in a red-gold frame, as well as that of his father. And in truth, when looking on the two, one could not conceive a greater contrast than must have existed between husband and wife. Mr. Van Coren must have been a man of terrible will and gloomy temperament. His face in the picture is dark and austere, his eyes deep sunken and burning as if with a slow inward fire. The lips are thin and compressed, with much determination of purpose, and his chin, boldly salient, is brimful of power and resolution. When first I saw those two pictures, I sighed inwardly and thought, "Poor child, you must have often sighed for the sunny meadows of Brussels in the long gloomy nights spent in the company of that terrible man." I was not far wrong, as I afterward discovered. Mr. and Mrs. Van Coren were very unhappy. Jealousy was his monomania, and he had scarcely been married before his girl wife began to feel the oppression of a gloomy and ceaseless tyranny. Every man under 50, whose hair was not white and whose form was erect, was an object of suspicion to this Dutch bluebeard. Not that he was vulgarly jealous. He did not frown at his wife before strangers, or attack her with reproaches in the midst of her festivities. He was too well-bred a man to bear his private woes to the world. But at night, when the guests had departed and the dull light of the quaint old Flemish lamps but half illuminated the nuptial chamber, then it was that with monotonous invective Mr. Van Coren crushed his wife. And Marie, weeping and silent, would sit on the edge of the bed, listening to the cold, trenchant irony of her husband, who, pacing up and down the room, would now and then stop in his walk to gaze with his burning eyes upon the pallid face of his victim. Even the evidences that Marie gave of becoming a mother did not check him. He saw in that coming event, which most husbands anticipate with mingled joy and fear, only an approaching incarnation of his dishonor. He watched with a horrible refinement of suspicion for the arrival of that being in whose features he madly believed he should but too surely trace the evidences of his wife's crime. Whether it was that these ceaseless attacks wore out her strength, or that Providence wished to add another chastening misery to her burden of woe, I dare not speculate. But it is certain that one luckless night Mr. Van Coren learned with fury that he had become a father 2 months before the allotted time. During his first paroxysm of rage, on the receipt of intelligence which seemed to confirm all his previous suspicions, it was, I believe, with difficulty that he was prevented from slaying both the innocent causes of his resentment. The caution of his race and the presence of the physicians induced him, however, to put a curb on his furious will until reflection suggested quite as criminal, if not as dangerous, a vengeance. As soon as his poor wife had recovered from her illness, unnaturally prolonged by the delicacy of constitution induced by previous mental suffering, she was astonished to find, instead of increasing his persecutions, that her husband had changed his tactics and treated her with studied neglect. He rarely spoke to her except on occasions when the decencies of society demanded that he should address her. He avoided her presence and no longer inhabited the same apartments. He seemed, in short, to strive as much as possible to forget her existence. But if she did not suffer from personal ill-treatment, it was because a punishment more acute was in store for her. If Mr. Van Coren had chosen to affect to consider her beneath his vengeance, it was because his hate had taken another direction, and seemed to have derived increased intensity from the alteration. It was upon the unhappy boy, the cause of all this misery, that the father lavished a terrible hatred. Mr. Van Coren seemed determined that, if this child sprang from other loins than his, the mournful destiny which he forced upon him should amply avenge his own existence and the infidelity of his mother. While the child was an infant, his plan seemed to have been formed. Ignorance and neglect were the two deadly influences with which he sought to assassinate the moral nature of this boy. And his terrible campaign against the virtue of his own son was, as he grew up, carried into execution with the most consummate generalship. He gave him money, but debarred him from education. He allowed him liberty of action, but withheld advice. It was in vain that his mother, who foresaw the frightful consequences of such a training, sought in secret by every means in her power to nullify her husband's attempts. She strove in vain to seduce her son into an ambition to be educated. She beheld with horror all her agonized efforts frustrated, and saw her son, an only child, becoming, even in his youth, a drunkard and a libertine. In the end, it proved too much for her strength. She sickened and went home to her sunny Belgian plains. There she lingered for a few months in a calm but rapid decay, whose calmness was broken but by the one grief, until one autumn day, when the leaves were falling from the limes, she made a little prayer for her son to the good God, and died. Vain Orison, spendthrift, gamester, libertine, and drunkard by turns, Alan Van Coren's earthly destiny was unchangeable. The father, who should have been his guide, looked on each fresh depravity of his sons with a species of grim delight. Even the death of his wronged wife had no effect upon his fatal purpose. he still permitted the young man to run blindly to destruction by the course into which he himself had led him. As years rolled by, and Mr. Van Coren himself approached to that time of life when he might soon expect to follow his persecuted wife, he relieved himself of the hateful presence of his son altogether. Even the link of a systematic vengeance, which had hitherto united them, was severed, and Allan was cast adrift without either money or principle. The occasion of this final separation between father and son was the marriage of the latter with a girl of humble, though honest, extraction. This was a good excuse for the remorseless Van Coren, so he availed himself of it by turning his son out of doors. From that time forth they never met. Allan lived a life of meager dissipation, and soon died, leaving behind him one child, a daughter. By a coincidence natural enough, Mr. Van Coren's death followed his son's almost immediately. He died as he had lived, sternly. But those who were around his couch in his last moments mentioned some singular facts connected with the manner of his death. A few moments before he expired, he raised himself in the bed and seemed as if conversing with some person invisible to the spectators. His lips moved as if in speech, and immediately afterward he sank back, bathed in a flood of tears. "Wrong! Wrong!" he was heard to mutter feebly. Then he implored passionately the forgiveness of someone who, he said, was present. The death struggle ensued almost immediately, and in the midst of his agony he seemed wrestling for speech. All that could be heard, however, were a few broken words. "I was wrong, my unfounded. For God's sake, look in. You will find..." Having uttered these fragmentary sentences, he seemed to feel that the power of speech had passed away forever. He fixed his eyes piteously on those around him, and, with a great sigh of grief, expired. I gathered these facts from his granddaughter and Allan's daughter, Alice Van Coren, who had been summoned by some friend to her grandfather's dying couch when it was too late. It was the first time she had seen him, and then she saw him die. The results of Mr. Van Coren's death were a 9 days' wonder to all the merchants in New York. Beyond a small sum in the bank, and the house in which he lived, which was mortgaged for its full value, Mr. Van Coren had died a pauper. To those who knew him and knew his affairs, this seemed inexplicable. 5 or 6 years before his death, he had retired from business with a fortune of several $100,000. He had lived quietly since then, was known not to have speculated, and could not have gambled. The question then was, where had his wealth vanished to? Search was made in every secretary, in every bureau, for some document which might throw a light on the mysterious disposition that he had made of his property. None was found. Neither will, nor certificates of stock, nor title deeds, nor bank accounts were anywhere discernible. Inquiries were made at the offices of companies in which Mr. Van Coren was known to be largely interested. He had sold out his stock years ago. Real estate that had been believed to be his was found on investigation to have passed into other hands. There could be no doubt that for some years past Mr. Van Coren had steadily been converting all his property into money, and what he had done with that money, no one knew. Alice Van Coren and her mother, who at the old gentleman's death were at first looked on as millionaires, discovered when all was over that they were no better off than before. It was evident that the old man determined that one whom, though bearing his name, he believed not to be of his blood, should never inherit his wealth or any share of it, had made away with his fortune before his death. A posthumous vengeance, which was the only one by which the laws of the state of New York relative to inheritance could be successfully evaded. I took a peculiar interest in the case, and even helped make some researches for the lost property. Not so much, I confess, from a spirit of general philanthropy, as from certain feelings which I experienced towards Alice Van Coren, the heir to this invisible estate. I had long known both her and her mother, when they were living in honest poverty and earning a scanty subsistence by their own labor. Mrs. Van Coren working as an embroideress, and Alice turning to account as a preparatory governess, the education which her good mother, in spite of her limited means, had bestowed on her. In a few words, then, I loved Alice Van Coren, and was determined to make her my wife as soon as my means would allow me to support a fitting establishment. My passion had never been declared. I was content for the time with the secret consciousness of my own love, and the no less grateful certainty that Alice returned it, all unuttered as it was. I had, therefore, a double interest in passing the summer at the old Dutch villa, for I felt it to be connected somehow with Alice, and I could not forget the singular desire to inhabit it, which I had so often experienced as a boy. It was a lovely day in June when Jasper Joyce and myself took up our abode in our new residence, and as we smoked our cigars on the piazza in the evening, we felt for the first time the unalloyed pleasure with which a townsman breathes the pure air of the country. The house and grounds had a quaint sort of beauty which, to me, was eminently pleasing. Landscape gardening, in the modern acceptation of the term, was then almost unknown in this country, and the laying out of the garden that surrounded our new home would doubtless have shocked Mr. Loudon, the late Mr. Downing, or Sir Thomas Dick Lauder. It was formal and artificial to the last degree. The beds were cut into long parallelograms, rigid and severe of aspect, and edged with prim rows of stiff dwarf box. The walks, of course, crossed always at right angles, and the laurel and cypress trees that grew here and there were clipped into cones and spheres and rhomboids. It is true that at the time my friend and I hired the house, years of neglect had restored to this formal garden somewhat of the raggedness of nature. The box edgings were rank and wild. The clipped trees, forgetful of geometric propriety, flourished into unauthorized boughs and rebel offshoots. The walks were green with moss, and the beds of Dutch tulips, which had been planted in the shape of certain gorgeous birds whose colors were represented by masses of blossoms, each of a single hue, had transgressed their limits, and the purple of a parrot's wings might have been seen running recklessly into the crimson of his head, while, as bulbs, however well bred, will create other bulbs, the flower birds of this queer old Dutch garden became in time abominably distorted in shape. Flamingos with humps, golden pheasants with legs preternaturally elongated, macaws afflicted with hydrocephalus, each species of deformity being proportioned to the rapidity with which the roots had spread in some particular direction. Still, this strange mixture of raggedness and formality, this conglomerate of nature and art, had its charms. It was pleasant to watch the struggle, as it were, between the opposing elements, and to see nature triumphing by degrees in every direction. The house itself was pleasant and commodious. Rooms that, though not lofty, were spacious. Wide windows and cool piazzas extending over the four sides of the building, and a collection of antique carved furniture, some of which, from its elaborateness, might well have come from the chisel of Master Grinling Gibbons. There was a mantelpiece in the dining room, with which I remember being very much struck when I first came to take possession. It was a singular and fantastical piece of carving. It was a perfect tropical garden, menagerie, and aviary in one. Birds, beasts, and flowers were sculptured on the wood with exquisite correctness of detail, and painted with the hues of nature. The Dutch taste for color was here fully gratified. Parrots, lovebirds, scarlet lories, blue-faced baboons, crocodiles, passion flowers, tigers, Egyptian lilies, and Brazilian butterflies were all mixed in gorgeous confusion. The artist, whoever he was, must have been an admirable naturalist, for the ease and freedom of his carving were only equaled by the wonderful accuracy with which the different animals were represented. Altogether, it was one of those oddities of Dutch conception whose strangeness was, in this instance, redeemed by the excellence of the execution. Such was the establishment that Jasper Joyce and myself were to inhabit for the summer months.
"What a strange thing it was," said Jasper, as we lounged on the piazza together the night of our arrival, "that old Van Coren's property should never have turned up."
"It is a question with some people whether he had any at his death," I answered.
"Pshaw! Everyone knows he did not or could not have lost that with which he retired from business."
"It is strange," said I thoughtfully. "Yet possible search has been made for documents that might throw light on the mystery. I have myself sought in every quarter for traces of this lost wealth, but in vain."
"Perhaps he buried it," suggested Jasper, laughing. "If so, we may find it here in a hole one fine morning."
"I think it much more likely that he destroyed it," I replied. "You know, he never could be got to believe that Allan Van Coren was his son, and I believe him quite capable of having flung all his money into the sea in order to prevent those whom he considered not of his blood inheriting it, which they must have done under our laws.
I am sorry that Alice did not become a heiress, both for your sake and hers. She is a charming girl."
Jasper, from whom I concealed nothing, knew of my love.
"As to that," I answered, "it is little matter. I shall in a year or two be independent enough to marry, and can afford to let Mr. Van Coren's cherished gold sleep wherever he has concealed it."
"Well, I'm off to bed," said Jasper, yawning. "This country air makes one sleepy early. Be on the lookout for trapdoors and all that sort of thing, old fellow. Who knows but the old chap's dollars will turn up? Good night."
"Good night, Jasper."
So we parted for the night, he to his room, which lay on the west side of the building, I to mine on the east, situated at the end of a long corridor and exactly opposite to Jasper's. The night was very still and warm. The clearness with which I heard the song of the katydid and the croak of the bullfrog seemed to make the silence more distinct. The air was dense and breathless, and although longing to throw wide my windows, I dared not, for outside the ominous trumpetings of an army of mosquitoes sounded threateningly. I tossed on my bed, oppressed with the heat, kicked the sheets into every spot where they ought not to be, turned my pillow every 2 minutes in the hope of finding a cool side. In short, did everything that a man does when he lays awake on a very hot night and cannot open his window. Suddenly, in the midst of my miseries, and when I had made up my mind to fling open the casement in spite of the legion of mosquitoes that I knew were hungrily waiting outside, I felt a continuous stream of cold air blowing upon my face. Luxurious as the sensation was, I could not help starting as I felt it. Where could this draught come from? The door was closed, so were the windows. It did not come from the direction of the fireplace, and even if it did, the air without was too still to produce so strong a current. I rose in my bed and gazed round the room, the whole of which, though only lit by a dim twilight, was still sufficiently visible. I thought at first it was a trick of Jasper's, who might have provided himself with a bellows or long tube, but a careful investigation of the apartment convinced me that no one was present. Besides, I had locked the door, and it was not likely that anyone had been concealed in the room before I entered it. It was exceedingly strange, but still the draught of cool wind blew on my face and chest, every now and then changing its direction, sometimes on one side, sometimes on the other.
I am not constitutionally nervous, and had been too long accustomed to reflect on philosophical subjects to become the prey of fear in the presence of mysterious phenomena. I had devoted much time to the investigation of what are popularly called supernatural matters, by those who have not reflected or examined sufficiently to discover that none of these apparent miracles are supernatural, but all, however singular, directly dependent on certain natural laws. I became speedily convinced, therefore, as I sat up in my bed, peering into the dim recesses of my chamber, that this mysterious wind was the effect of a forerunner of a supernatural visitation, and I mentally determined to investigate it, as it developed itself, with a philosophical calmness. "Is anyone in this room?" I asked as distinctly as I could. No reply, while the cool wind still swept over my cheek. I knew, in the case of Elizabeth Esslinger, who was visited by an apparition while in the Winesburg jail, and whose singular and apparently authentic experiences were made the subject of a book by Dr. Kerner, that the manifestation of the spirit was invariably accompanied by such a breezy sensation as I now experienced. I therefore gathered my will, as it were, into a focus, and endeavored, as much as lay in my power, to put myself in accord with the disembodied spirit, if such there were, knowing that on such conditions alone would it be enabled to manifest itself to me. Presently it seemed as if a luminous cloud was gathering in one corner of the room, a sort of dim phosphoric vapor, shadowy and ill-defined. It changed its position frequently, sometimes coming nearer, and at others retreating to the furthest end of the room. As it grew intenser and more radiant, I observed a sickening and corpse-like odor diffuse itself through the chamber, and despite my anxiety to witness this phenomenon undisturbed, I could with difficulty conquer a feeling of faintness which oppressed me. The luminous cloud now began to grow brighter and brighter as I gazed. The horrible odor of which I have spoken did not cease to oppress me, and gradually I could discover certain lines making themselves visible in the midst of this lambent radiance. These lines took the form of a human figure, a tall man clothed in a long dressing robe, with a pale countenance, burning eyes, and a very bold and prominent chin. At a glance, I recognized the original of the picture of old Van Koren that I had seen with Alice. My interest was now aroused to the highest point. I felt that I stood face to face with a spirit, and doubted not that I should learn the fate of the old man's mysteriously concealed wealth. The spirit presented a very strange appearance. He himself was not luminous, except some tongues of fire that seemed to proceed from the tips of his fingers, but was completely surrounded by a thin gauze of light, so to speak, through which his outlines were visible. His head was bare, and his white hair fell in huge masses around his stern, saturnine face. As he moved on the floor, I distinctly heard a strange crackling sound, such as one hears when a substance has been overcharged with electricity. But the circumstance that seemed to me most incomprehensible connected with the apparition was that Van Koren held in both hands a curiously painted flower pot, out of which sprang a number of the most beautiful tulips in full blossom. He seemed very uneasy and agitated, and moved about the room as if in pain, frequently bending over the pot of tulips as if to inhale their odor, then holding it out to me, seemingly in the hope of attracting my attention to it. I was, I confess, very much puzzled. I knew that Mr. Van Koren had, in his lifetime, devoted much of his leisure to the cultivation of flowers, importing from Holland the most expensive and rarest bulbs.
but how this innocent fancy could trouble him after death I could not imagine. I felt assured, however, that some important reason lay at the bottom of this spectral eccentricity, and determined to fathom it if I could. "What brings you here?" I asked audibly, directing mentally, however, at the same time, the question to the spirit with all the power of my will. He did not seem to hear me, but still kept moving uneasily about with the crackling noise that I have mentioned, and holding the pot of tulips toward me. "It is evident," I said to myself, "that I am not sufficiently in accord with this spirit for him to make himself understood by speech. He has, therefore, recourse to symbols. The pot of tulips is a symbol, but of what?" Thus reflecting on these things, I continued to gaze upon the spirit. While observing him attentively, he approached my bedside by a rapid movement and laid one hand on my arm. The touch was icy cold, and pained me at the moment. Next morning my arm was swollen and marked with a round blue spot. Then, passing to my bedroom door, the spirit opened it and went out, shutting it behind him. Catching for a moment at the idea that I was the dupe of a trick, I jumped out of bed and ran to the door. It was locked with a key on the inside, and a brass safety bolt, which lay above the lock, shot safely home. All was as I had left it on going to bed. Yet I declare most solemnly that as the ghost made his exit, I not only saw the door open, but I saw the corridor outside, and distinctly observed a large picture of William of Orange, that hung just opposite to my room. This, to me, was the most curious portion of the phenomenon that I had witnessed. Either the door had been opened by the ghost, and the resistance of physical obstacles overcome in some amazing manner, because, in this case, the bolts must have been replaced when the ghost was outside the door, or he must have had a sufficient magnetic accord with my mind to impress upon it the belief that the door was opened, and also to conjure up in my brain the vision of the corridor and the picture, features that I should have seen if the door had been opened by any ordinary physical agency. The next morning at breakfast, I suppose my manner must have betrayed me, for Jasper said to me, after staring at me for some time, "Why, Harry Escott, what's the matter with you? You look as if you had seen a ghost." "So I have, Jasper." Jasper, of course, burst into laughter and said he'd shave my head and give me a shower bath. "Well, you may laugh," I answered, "but you shall see it tonight, Jasper." He became serious in a moment. I suppose there was something earnest in my manner that convinced him that my words were not idle, and asked me to explain. I described my interview as accurately as I could. "How did you know it was old Van Coren?" he asked. "Because I have seen his picture 100 times with Alice," I answered, "and this apparition was as like it as it was possible for a ghost to be like a miniature." "You must not think I'm laughing at you, Harry," he continued, "but I wish you would answer this. We have all heard of ghosts of men, women, children, dogs, horses, in fact, every living animal. But hang me if I ever heard of a ghost of a flower pot before." "My dear Jasper, you would have heard of such things if you had studied such branches of learning. All the phenomena I witnessed last night are supportable by well-authenticated facts. The cool wind has attended the appearance of more than one ghost, and Baron Reichenbach asserts that his patients, who, you know, are for the most part sensitive to apparitions, invariably feel this wind when a magnet is brought close to their bodies. With regard to the flower pot about which you make so merry, it is to me the least wonderful portion of the apparition. When a ghost is unable to find a person of sufficient receptivity in order to communicate with him by speech, it is obliged to have recourse to symbols to express its wishes. These it either creates by some mysterious power out of the surrounding atmosphere, or it impresses, by magnetic force on the mind of the person it visits, the form of the symbol it is anxious to have represented. There is an instance mentioned by Jung Stilling of a student at Brunswick, who appeared to a professor of his college with a picture in his hands, which picture had a hole in it that the ghost thrust his head through. For a long time this symbol was a mystery, but the student was persevering, and appeared every night with his head through the picture, until at last it was discovered that before he died he had got some painted slides for a magic lantern from a shopkeeper in the town, which had not been paid for at his death. And when the debt had been discharged, he and his picture vanished forevermore. Now, here was a symbol distinctly bearing on the question at issue. This poor student could find no better way of expressing his uneasiness at the debt for the painted slides than by thrusting his head through a picture. How he conjured up the picture, I cannot pretend to explain, but that it was used as a symbol is evident.
Then you think the flower pot of old Van Coren is a symbol?
Most assuredly, the pot of tulips he held was intended to express that which he could not speak. I think it must have had some reference to his missing property, and it is our business to discover in what manner.
Let us go and dig up all the tulip beds, said Jasper. Who knows but what he may have buried his money in one of them?
I grieve to say that I assented to Jasper's proposition. And on that eventful day, every tulip in that quaint old garden was ruthlessly uprooted. The gorgeous macaws and ragged parrots and long-legged pheasants, so cunningly formed by those brilliant flowers, were that day exterminated. Jasper and I had a regular battue amidst this floral preserve, and many a splendid bird fell before our unerring spades. We, however, dug in vain. No secret coffer turned up out of the deep mold of the flower beds. We evidently were not on the right scent. Our researches for that day terminated, and Jasper and myself waited impatiently for the night. It was arranged that Jasper should sleep in my room. I had a bed rigged up for him near my own, and I was to have the additional assistance of his senses in the investigation of the phenomena that we so confidently expected to appear. The night came. We retired to our respective couches, after carefully bolting the doors, and subjecting the entire apartment to the strictest scrutiny, rendering it totally impossible that a secret entrance should exist unknown to us. We then put out the lights and awaited the apparition. We did not remain in suspense long. About 20 minutes after we retired to bed, Jasper called out,
"Harry, I feel the cool wind."
"So do I," I answered, for at that moment a light breeze seemed to play across my temples.
"Look, look, Harry," continued Jasper in a tone of painful eagerness. "I see a light, there in the corner."
It was the phantom. As before, the luminous cloud appeared to gather in the room, growing more and more intense each minute. Presently the dark lines mapped themselves out, as it were, in the midst of this pale, radiant vapor. And there stood Mr. Van Coren, ghastly and mournful as ever, with the pot of tulips in his hands.
"Do you see it?" I asked Jasper. "My God, yes," said Jasper in a low voice. "How terrible he looks!"
"Can you speak to me tonight?" I said, addressing the apparition, and again concentrating my will upon my question. "If so, unburden yourself. We will assist you if we can." There was no reply. The ghost preserved the same sad, impassive countenance. He had heard me not. He seemed in great distress on this occasion, moving up and down and holding out the pot of tulips imploringly towards me, each motion of his being each motion of his being accompanied by the crackling noise and the corpse-like odor. I felt sorely troubled myself to see this poor spirit torn by an endless grief, so anxious to communicate to me what lay on his soul, and yet debarred by some occult power from the privilege. "Why, Harry!" cried Jasper after a silence, during which we both watched the motions of the ghost intently. "Why, Harry, my boy, there are two of them!" Astonished by his words, I looked around, and became immediately aware of the presence of a second luminous cloud, in the midst of which I could distinctly trace the figure of a pale but lovely woman. I needed no second glance to assure me that it was the unfortunate wife of Van Koren. "It is his wife, Jasper," I replied. "I recognize her as I have recognized her husband by the portrait." "How sad she looks!" exclaimed Jasper in a low voice. She did indeed look sad. Her face, pale and mournful, did not, however, seem convulsed with grief. Convulsed with sorrow, as was her husband's, she seemed to be oppressed with a calm grief, and gazed with a look of interest that was painful in its intensity on Van Koren. It struck me, from his air, that though she saw him, he did not see her. His whole attention was concentrated on the pot of tulips, while Mrs. Van Koren, who floated at an elevation of about 3 feet from the floor, and thus overtopped her husband, seemed equally absorbed in the contemplation of his slightest movement. Occasionally she would turn her eyes on me, as if to call my attention to her companion, and then, returning, gaze on him with a sad, womanly, half-eager smile that to me was inexpressibly mournful. There was something exceedingly touching in this strange sight, these two spirits so near, yet so distant, the sinful husband torn with grief and weighed down with some terrible secret, and so blinded by the grossness of his being as to be unable to see the wife angel who was watching over him, while she, forgetting all her wrongs and attracted to earth by perhaps the same human sympathies, watched from a greater spiritual height, and with a tender interest, the struggles of her suffering spouse. "By Jove!" exclaimed Jasper, jumping from his bed. "I know what it means now." "What does it mean?" I asked, as eager to know as he was to communicate. "Well, that flower pot that the old chap is holding—" Jasper, I grieve to say, was rather profane. "Well, what of that flower pot?" "Observe the pattern. It has two handles made of red snakes, whose tails twist round the top and form a rim. It contains tulips of three colors, yellow, red, and purple." "I see all that as well as you do. Let us have the solution." "Well, Harry, my boy, don't you remember that there is just such a flower pot, tulips, snakes, and all, carved on the queer old painted mantelpiece in the dining room?" "So there is!" And a gleam of hope shot across my brain, and my heart beat quicker. "Now, as sure as you are alive, Harry, the old fellow has concealed something important behind that mantelpiece." "Jasper, if ever I am Emperor of France, I will make you Chief of Police. Your inductive reasoning is magnificent." Actuated by the same impulse, and without another word, we both sprang out of bed and lit a candle. The apparitions, if they remained, were no longer visible in the light. Hastily throwing on some clothes, we rushed downstairs to the dining room, determined to have the old mantelpiece down without loss of time. We had scarce entered the room when we felt the cool wind blowing on our faces. "Jasper," said I, "they are here." "Well," answered Jasper, "that only confirms my suspicions that we are on the right track this time. Let us go to work. See, here's the pot of tulips." This pot of tulips, occupied the center of the mantelpiece and served as a nucleus round which all the fantastic animals sculptured elsewhere might be said to gather. It was carved on a species of raised shield or boss of wood that projected some inches beyond the plane of the remainder of the mantelpiece. The pot itself was painted a brick color. The snakes were of bronze color, gilt, and the tulips, yellow, red, and purple, were painted after nature with the most exquisite accuracy. For some time, Jasper and myself tugged away at this projection without any avail. We were convinced that it was a movable panel of some kind, but yet were totally unable to move it. Suddenly it struck me that we had not yet twisted it. I immediately proceeded to apply all my strength, and after a few seconds of vigorous exertion, I had the satisfaction of finding it move slowly round. After giving it half a dozen turns, to my astonishment, the long upper panel of the mantelpiece fell out towards us, apparently on concealed hinges, after the manner of a portion of escritoires that is used as a writing table. Within were several square cavities sunk in the wall and lined with wood. In one of these was a bundle of papers. We seized these papers with avidity and hastily glanced over them. They proved to be documents vouching for property to the amount of several hundred thousand dollars, invested in the name of Mr. Van Coren in a certain firm at Bremen, who, no doubt, thought by this time that the money would remain unclaimed forever. The desires of these poor troubled spirits were accomplished. Justice to the child had been given through the instrumentality of the erring father. The formulas necessary to prove Alice and her mother sole heirs of Mr. Van Coren's estate were briefly gone through, and the poor governess passed suddenly from the task of teaching stupid children to the envied position of a great heiress. I had ample reason afterward for thinking that her heart did not change with her fortunes. That Mr. Van Coren became aware of his wife's innocence just before he died, I have no doubt. How this was manifested, I cannot, of course, say, but I think it highly probable that his poor wife herself was enabled at the critical moment of dissolution, when the link that binds body and soul together is attenuated to the last thread, to put herself in accord with her unhappy husband. Hence his sudden starting up in his bed, his apparent conversation with some invisible being, and his fragmentary disclosures, too broken, however, to be comprehended. The question of apparitions has been so often discussed that I feel no inclination to enter here upon the truth or fallacy of the ghostly theory. I myself believe in ghosts. Alice, my wife, believes in them firmly. And if it suited me to do so, I could overwhelm you with a scientific theory of my own on the subject, reconciling ghosts and natural phenomena. The End.